You're listening to Wake Up with Patty Catter, where we're overcoming trials with triumphs. Now, here's your host, Patty Catter.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for joining me again on Wake Up with Patty Catter. Of course, I am Patty Catter. Today, I have with me Johnny Shattuck. John, welcome to my show.
Very nice to have you having me on, Patty. Just so for the audience's sake, I met Patty in mid-June, I believe it was, in Washington, D.C., at the Gold Institute Black Tie event, where we had a roundtable discussion on matters pertaining to the U.S. involvement overseas and, the U.S. In general. And we met at that event where I was a board member of the Gold Institute. But I'm John Shattuck, 58 years old, originally from Chicago, now reside in Arizona. Came to Arizona 8 years ago to retire. Didn't really retire, so there's that. So again, a Chicago native, like most military personnel or people who join the Navy or armed services, I did so while I was in high school. I was in what was called a delayed entry program. Went in, I think I was, 17, had to get parents' permission. Of course, they said, where do we sign? So, with that said, I went into delayed entry program, went in the Navy, and that was to really get away from some of the nuances of growing up on the South Side of Chicago type of situation. But anyways, go ahead.
Yeah. So I'm kind of curious about that. I lived in Michigan and we were pretty rural in our area, but we did have some tough cities. So I knew some kids that I went to school with, they joined the military to kind of get out of that situation. When you did join the military, I'm just kind of curious, were you excited about it? Or when you joined, were you like, what the heck did I just do?
Well, that's a double-edged sword. So basically, when I say we grew up in Chicago, we were in the suburbs technically, but there was a lot of dynamics growing up where I was kind of running with the wrong crowd, dodging bullets. It was a wake-up call to go, okay, I need something different. Me and a buddy went over to the recruiting station, and this is a story that exists with a lot of people in the military. At that time, this is like 1983, you walked into a building and each recruiter was in different like offices and the same strip mall type of thing, right? So, I walked in, looked at the Army, that looks interesting. I looked at the Marines, thought, yeah, I can do that. But then I was really interested in the Air Force, or not necessarily Air Force, being an airman or doing something relative to aviation. Went over to the Air Force, nobody there, nobody there to talk to. I went, okay, that's a sign. Walked past the Navy and I see this burly guy, he had a beard, and it was interesting. It was a recruiter, he had sleeves, tattoos on his arms. And I thought, I can do this. And we hit it off, and actually I joined the Navy. It's kind of a funny story because back in that year or right around that time, you can still had a beard. Not in special ops, just in general, you could wear a beard. I thought, that's where I'm going and I can travel the world. So me and a buddy of mine, we actually signed up together. He ended up doing sub duty and I went naval air. But so that's the story of joining the Navy. But, the Navy gave me an experience, woke me up, afforded me an opportunity to see the world. My Navy career was, uneventful and not a long-term thing. It was more inexperienced out, and then I started with my life. But the Navy taught me to be self-sufficient and again woke me up to seeing parts of the world that I thought were our allies, and they still even back then kind of looked at us a little bit differently. And I thought, in fact, when I was in the Navy, we went to, this is a little personal, but we went to, one of our ports was, in Italy, and I was in the USS Nimitz, and we had pulled into port. Apparently the Nimitz hadn't been in port for I don't know if they had said years. I don't know if that's true or not. But we had an opportunity to go to the Vatican. And there I was in St. Peter's Square with a group of group from the Nimitz. And Pope John Paul was there. And he came right up to me within the crowd and just, you know, kind of blessed me. And I wasn't baptized. I wasn't confirmed. I had no religious background. And that was kind of my point where I looked up, saw the apostles and thought, boy, is there more to this? And so that was 1984, 85 maybe when we were in port. But so that kind of led to some of the circumstances fast forward 10, 20, 30 years later. But, you know, I don't know what else I can go on with the story, but you let me know where you want it to go.
Mm. Well, I really am kind of curious too. So you know, you were saying basically you didn't feel like your Navy experience was very long lived. What in the world were you thinking when you were getting out of the Navy? I guess that would be my next question.
You know, getting out was just, it was more of a transition. There was some things that happened, nothing terrible, but it was, I knew what I wanted to do. I knew I was a doer more than a follower, I guess I would say. So when I got out of the Navy, I went in business for myself kind of right out of the gate. I, you know, started my own business, but I met my wife, which we've been married for 32 years. And that's where the story begins, because what had happened is, you know, early on in life, yeah, I was always involved with things that were, if somebody was wronged or somebody was bullied, you know, I just wouldn't put up with that. And, you know, so I got in a few fights and it was more defending people and, you know, never really looked at it that way at that time because it was like a defense mechanism. So just considered, you know, looking at the Navy, look at me in boot camp. I'm that guy with that grin on his face where the company commander is yelling at you. And I'm like, that's all you got? Really? Like, come on. But, you know, not to diminish their tactics, but, you know, my childhood was one that was, you know, I was kicked out of high school two times before I even went to Navy. And I went back to high school to finish to prove them that I can do it. And, you know, didn't go out with the GED, actually went out, you know, graduating, had to repeat my senior year and night school and summer school. And that was during a delayed entry program. They said, you didn't need to do that. But I said, you know, I'm going to do it. But so that's what I did. When I got out of the Navy, I met my wife. And, you know, soon thereafter, a year and a half or so after, we had our first son. And this is where I get a little hard for me to talk about it, but our first son, you know, it changed my life. And he got sick when he was about a year and a half, 2 years old. And I knew it, there was something wrong. And he was diagnosed with leukemia. And that was 4 years of hell. It was 4 years of hell. It, you know, I got very involved in, as I usually do, advocating. You know, when somebody tells you your son is ill, or somebody or yourself, you know, a lot of people just say, you know, trust the doctors. And I understand that, but I'm a trust but verify guy. And so right out of the gate, you know, I walked around with bone marrow slides of my son's aspiration to determine what type of cancer he had. And he had a very rare form, one found in about 100 children a year. That was a chromosomal translocation. But I became immersed in understanding the dynamics of his treatment, his diagnosis. And I actually found a physician who was a, what they call a pediatric oncology investigator, not just a treating physician, but the person who actually writes these protocols, an amazing doctor out of Syria who came to the United States and said, I know they're telling you your son has this particular type of cancer or developing in, but we believe it to be something else. And that man saved his life. And we're close to this day. Hence me talking to you today was, you know, and I'll kind of fast forward and go back, but the reason why we're talking today, I don't do many of these because I'm a behind the scenes kind of guy, But on July 1st, my wife fell, you know, while we were up in northern Arizona, broke several bones in her body, basically her whole left side. While I was caring for her, I started getting super tired. And like, I'm always going. And it was as if somebody just throttled me down and just, I hit a wall. And I knew something was wrong. Went to the doctor at Mayo Clinic. They said, you're exhausted. You're just burning the candle at both ends. You need to slow down. I said, no, that ain't it. And so basically, and I'll go back to this later, but they diagnosed me within the last couple of weeks with throat cancer, found in white male heterosexual non-smokers age 50 to 60. So I guess I'm checking all the boxes. And so we're, you know, dealing with that. So basically, that's happening in 2 days. They're doing a lot of surgeries and radiation, but I wanted to tell my story a little bit before I'm silenced. Hopefully not for good. Maybe I'll just sideline for a bit. But anyways, back to my son. You know, he went through 4 years of hell. And, you know, when he was going through his treatment, you know, I was that guy that back in the day, you know, computers in the 80s were just kind of evolving, right? So nobody had a laptop per se. Maybe they were just starting to come out, but, you know, many people didn't have access to that. So I was in the physician's library every day for like 9 months while my son was inpatient. And I was pulling looking at thousands of abstract case studies, pulling microfiche down, looking at articles, understanding what his type of cancer was. And the hospital at the time, I would sign in. I would just, you know, I'm a rule follower. So I walked into the library and I'd sign my name. And I did this for months, until one of the people in the library at the hospital said, Dr. Shattuck, I noticed you're just signing John Shattuck. I said, what do you mean? I'm not a doctor. I'm not a doctor. I'm the parent of a child that's up in the cancer ward. And they allowed me to continue to be in there. But that's kind of the way my life has went. I've had opportunities to do things where I wasn't like formally trained, but I was going to learn on the fly. Anyways, my son went through that journey. He came out the other side. He's 30 years old now, has two children. But that experience and that involvement, I had a very successful business at the time. And I realized, you know, I need to start focusing. Not that I didn't focus on my kids, because I was there every step of the way. But, you know, I needed to change gears and start giving back. And so I was, during that experience, I met somebody, and we all meet people, or I hope we meet people that will say, I'll follow that person to the ends of the earth. And that was an associate pastor at our church who was just newly ordained. And he's now the bishop of an archdiocese outside of Chicago, the Joliet Diocese. He introduced me to charity and giving back, because I wanted to do something. And I found, that's where I found my niche. And my niche wasn't a monetary side of things, because I always allocated so much money per year to travel and donating my time, you know, time, talent, and treasure. And we started doing that. And I started doing that with the assistance of this particular pastor, who was very close with an institution called Nuestros Pequeños Hermanos, which is our little brothers and sisters. And they've been around since 1954. And what they would do is they would educate and take in orphan and abandoned children in 9 Latin American countries. So I said, I'm all in. I want to go see. But most people would just donate or spend a couple weeks. I went down and I went down for years. And what I found was that there was an extreme need. And I'm not a fundraiser per se. I don't really get involved on the monetary side of things, because I feel that, you know, I'd rather have people, you know, donate product or time for something. And I realized I had a niche for something, and that was getting corporations and individuals to purchase things rather than give us money and, you know, help, not necessarily sponsor a child for $30 a month type of thing. It was, no, here's a container full of food we purchased. Would you pay for that shipping? And I started doing that in 9 Latin American countries. It was astounding, and it was amazing to see the work that was involved you know, finally an institution that's putting their money where their mouth is, and they were so open and transparent. So I became uber involved in that institution as the board chair out of Chicago. But I was the logistics guy. So I would go down, I started visiting the country, seeing what they needed, and went back and, you know, kind of pulled things together. So during that experience though, you know, you're working in a lot of hotspots, and I landed in Haiti, which was one of the 9 countries we work in, and Haiti changed my life. And Haiti changed my life, and it was prior to the earthquake of 2010. It was, talk about like sensory overload. It was just, you know, good and evil. I mean, we were seeing the good in people, we were seeing the evil in people, we were seeing, you know, the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, and that's before the country fell apart. And, you know, we did a lot of good. We'd been down there for decades before my introduction, and we sent over $30 million in aid down there, not in money, in actually things, whether it was medical supplies. So I started collecting shipping containers, 40-foot shipping containers, sending, going down to address the earthquake in 2010. And I found that hospitals and networks in the United States, you know, everything is so litigious. So there would be, you know, medical equipment, not necessarily meds, but medical equipment, beds, and, you know, services that would otherwise expire, that were still perfectly good. And they were going to put them in a landfill. I decided, well, what can we do with this? I went back down to Haiti, and we had the only free children's hospital in the country, which ended up being ground zero for the United Nations and the U.S. and the Italian military during the earthquake. And I was right there in the thick of things for a long time down there. And we just kept shipping these containers down, and, you know, the airport was destroyed. The port was destroyed. So we would actually have to take it into the Dominican Republic, and I would escort these things overland, and we'd get them over into Port-au-Prince. But Haiti changed me forever, because I lost several friends during the earthquake, Americans and Haitians. But during that work in all these Latin American countries, Americans go and travel with the false impression that, hey, I'm an American, I'm safe, I'm exempt. The State Department, our government's going to help me if somebody extorts me or kidnaps me. Well, I'm here to tell you that very few times do administrations really get involved in that aspect. And I can understand to some degree, because, you know, if you're traveling into an area that there's warnings, the same way when you're in the Navy, you know, if we pulled into a port and they said that bars off limits, you're screwed if you get caught over there. Well, you know, half the Navy guys are going, well, that's where we're going. But, you know, with that said, I started getting involved with, in Haiti, a number of Americans, even in 2010, 11, 12, were being extorted and kidnapped. So they had desperate people doing desperate things. And it started with me helping a priest out down there that just, the man was amazing. You know, he still is. He's Father Rick Frechette. He's a passionist priest that became a doctor at age 40, and built the only free children's hospital in the country. And, you know, his following is like nothing I've ever seen before. So in a sense, I was kind of one of his, you know, underlings, and I was watching him navigate the nuances of helping people at the same time Americans be getting in trouble. And his attention was diverted, because he would have to address with the gangs or the corrupt officials that were extorting these Americans or, you know, arresting them. And I helped him. I watched him and I helped him for a bit. And then I became the guy. I became the guy about 2011 or 12, when 2 Americans were taken, Stephen Parker Shaw and Zeke Petrie. One was a fixer, which is somebody that helps foreign journalists or, you know, navigate through tough spots. And one was a contractor who was not a military contractor, a contractor building homes and churches, donating his time. Well, they were arrested. They were arrested for conspiracy to overthrow the country and attempted murder. How about those charges? I was contacted, because they knew I was involved in behind the scenes and some other releases, or, you know, I guess you would call myself a bit of a mediator. I'm unpaid. I'm not an attorney. So I'm just telling the truth. And we try to, you know, separate politics from rhetoric and get things done. I'm not a word master. I don't write well, but I speak from the heart. So a lot of the things we do is one-on-one. I'll go down, I'll talk to judges. We'll, you know, get to the bottom of things and how it's providence for me. So how did I get involved with doing this? So these two Americans were the first two that became public, very public. What happened is they were being tortured. They were left in a cell with 110 other men, no place, no food, no place to sleep. It's very well chronicled. I mean, there's been documentaries and many articles about this, but we were working behind the scenes to free them. And we got it done, and it went down. I got a call from this priest, and he goes, okay, John, you've got it to where you need to come down. You need to get them out of there. I went to the courthouse, went to pull them out. And unfortunately, it made the news, and it made the news big time. Like Chief Justice Brady says, the two Americans are freed and it's unconditional. And John Shattuck, so now this is the first time my name's in public, says, oh no, the arrangement with the judge is that it's unconditional and he's taking them out of the country. Well, what amounts to the attorney general in that country had an axe to grind with me because I got involved in the case, because it was really more of an extortion or an attempt to shake down these Americans. Now, I wasn't going to have it. So suddenly, you know, I'm on USA Today, or it's all over the news. And now I have to counter that because I've never been in the public eye. We had to write articles in response to that to kind of explain what was going on. And so that's how I became public, in a sense, helping these folks. But shortly thereafter, I get home, settling down, trying to process everything I just dealt with in Haiti. And I get another phone call. And it's a lady from the East Coast saying, I read about you helping, you know, Zeke and Steve. What about Lillian? And I said, who's Lillian? Lillian Miller, African-American woman from Washington, D.C., was starting a housing program. I sent you the link on a little documentary we did about this. And she was extorted by the same person, the same government official. And they had tortured her. They had raped her. They left her to die. And she had very public pleas with then the Obama administration at the time. And that's all before I was involved. I mean, it was very public, and I was sent this information, and I thought, here we go again. So that one was far more difficult. We did get her out, and we actually went to the State Department, asked for their help, and they said they would help. In moments before, I went down to get this resolved, and I had some people in the press from CBS. One sec. From CBS helping me. I won't name the outlet that they were working for at CBS, but a producer wanted to go down to chronicle why are Americans being held and what's going on, why the administration's not getting involved. Well, somebody put the brakes on it and said that this producer couldn't go down and they were no longer going to film this through this documentary. Well, a very now close friend and patriot went down with me, without a whole crew, but with himself, with all his gear. And he chronicled the whole thing. And we got Lillian out, and it wasn't about what I did. It was about the circumstances of Lillian and others, you know, allowing these, you know, failed states and, you know, gangs and stuff to take Americans. So we did this, and that was over 10 years ago. And so we stay close with the people that we've helped, but what's happened since is there's been hundreds. The phone, I'm not part of any institution per se. We're just individuals. So somehow they get our numbers and the phones ring. People tell me with my current medical condition, John, you need to put that aside. I'm like, how do you do that? How do you change your stripes? How do you, you know, yes, I need to take care of myself. Yes, I got to get better, but but if I I'd have to shut my phone off. So, you know, I will tell you that, so that was Haiti. And then it happened in so many different countries, Mexico, Egypt. I started getting calls all over, and I got real close down in Haiti with an organization called Artists for Peace and Justice. And it was what a wild experience that was. I was coming down the mountain with a buddy of mine. His name was John as well, you know, very wealthy individual. And we're coming down from one of our trips of helping and come into our compound, and in walks like 8 or 10 people kind of in a line this way, right? And they're walking towards us. We're exhausted. I mean, we're 8 hours down the mountain, 110 degrees out. It was terrible. We were cooked. We were, you know, we were raisins by that time, and dehydrated. And I heard this person calling out, John, John, John. They're kind of running towards me, us. And I'm thinking they're talking about John because he's got the money. I don't got the money. And then I get this guy going, no, John Chaddock, I need to talk to you. It was Paul Haggis. And Paul's an interesting guy. He founded Artists for Peace and Justice and support for Haiti. And so basically, he's a Canadian filmmaker. He founded Artists for Peace and Justice. He did the movie Crash, Million Dollar Baby, all the recent Bond movies, a lot of the old TV shows like Facts of Life and L.A. Law. And didn't know anything about this guy, didn't know anything about that world. But with him was Demi Moore, Susan Sarandon, Gerard Butler, Olivia Wilde, all these people. I didn't know who the hell they were. And they're like, you're coming to dinner with us tonight. I'm like, I just came down from the mountain. I'm exhausted. So next thing I know, I'm sitting with all these guys, and he needs help. He needs help on the logistics side, saying, how are you getting this stuff in country? We need to build a school for all these children who've lost their parents. And so I got involved with this institution, and, you know, hey, I have a lot of, so I'm known as their conservative friend, right? So it was interesting. So all these individuals that work in Hollywood, and I became close with a lot of them, you know, there's that public persona and there's that private persona. And I got to know them personally. And I'm here to tell you not to deviate from what we do, but it's part of my nuances of, you know, working with people, is that so many of them are living a lie. Probably get in trouble for saying that, but they're afraid to discuss their true feelings or their beliefs, because they're going to be typecast or not afforded opportunities. So I worked with them for years, and I was able to help in other situations. I just got back, and I was at TIFF with Artists for Peace and Justice at a film screening for some documentaries we were doing relative to humanitarian work. And I sit down, I get in there, and one of my colleagues from APJ said, John, did you hear about Tarek Lubani and John Grace? And I go, who? Two Canadians, you know, thrown in a prison in Egypt. Coming in through the Gaza Strip, helping. And so it started again. So these things just continue to help. So now that we're in Egypt, and we're working in Egypt, and I had a, be careful how I say this. I was working as an assistant to General Patrick Ray, a retired Brigadier General. And we were working on kind of Christian outreach programs in the Middle East. And so we became close with King Abdullah. And so that whole dynamic was able to help resolve the two Canadians that were being tortured. They were filmmakers, but the phone just kept ringing off the hook over the years. And I was able to do so because I'm self-employed and allocating a lot of my time to do so. But I always joke when people talk about the military, and I'll get to military in a second, is that my military time was in the very early 1980s. It was in, it was out. I was done. I went on with my life. And but it certainly propelled me to be my own man and taught me to be self-sufficient. So what had happened is, you know, with the first military personnel. I've been involved in several other Americans being wrongly, you know, held or convicted or extorted or, you know, in other countries. But I hadn't really worked in the U.S. regarding things or with military personnel for that matter. So the very first one was Sergeant Andrew Tamarisi. You might have known his name. He was a Marine. Marine? It was Army. I get confused anymore. I think it was Marine that traveled over the border in Arizona and was jailed for having a firearm in the back of his vehicle. And so I worked with his mother and a lot of the people behind the scenes and a lot of congressmen and senators to get to pave the way. And a couple people really jumped in. And what blew my mind was you know, a lot of politicians will take credit. And none of this is about taking credit for anything because it's a, I hate to use the word because somebody ruined it, is, you know, it takes a village. But with that said, it does. You know, if we don't work together on these things, then, you know, nothing's going to get resolved. If we don't talk to the people that we need to talk to, then nothing gets resolved. But Andrew was released, and the one person that stuck out, well, two people. I had an opportunity to meet with Governor Rick Perry, and completely happenstance. You know, I was in, my stories can go on forever, and my stories are more about how in God's name did I get put in a position to be able to be involved with something. And I'm here to tell you, it ain't me. It ain't me. So people can take that for what it's worth, but I'm in Clear Lake, Iowa, going to Winnebago, which is the RV company, to, you know, have another RV built. We're big RVers. And I'm at some little diner, and I meet this guy whose his father was the, you know, attorney general of the state. And, you know, they brought me into their house that night, and they said, what are you doing tomorrow? And I said, well, I'm going to, you know, Winnebago Industries to look at an RV being built. And they said, we would like you to meet with, you know, the governor of Iowa, Terry Branstad, who ended up being the ambassador to China under Trump. And Terry was, we hit it off and we started talking about things. And they said, well, what are you doing tomorrow? Now, this is after I'm on some boat meeting with the governor. I'm going, what's this? And the next day I'm at an airport hangar, and Governor Perry had announced his bid for presidential office. And I was still living in Chicago, thinking about moving to Texas or Arizona. I couldn't figure out. I knew I needed to be away from the cold, and I needed, you know, I needed that because, you know, there's some history. I broke my back and hip and neck a few years before and told I was never going to walk again. So I'm at this thing, and Governor Perry pulls me to the side, and he says, I hear you want to move to Texas or Arizona. And he goes, I want you to go to Texas. Well, I ended up going to Arizona. But at that point, I got to meet him as a person, and we discussed what was happening at the border at the time, which was here we are all these years later, all these children and people coming across the border illegally. And while it's a humanitarian issue, it's also a safety issue and a concern. And that's my chief concern, is really, I have empathy, but if there's a rule of law and there's a way to do things. And so he helped me with that. But what else he helped me with was Sergeant Tamarisi's release in a way to do it. And so actually Montel Williams, remember that talk show host?
Of course, I know Montel.
So Montel was a Marine. He was really the one that went down there and got Andrew. But, you know, there was a lot of people involved in the paving the way to get some of these corrupt individuals. And I'll tell you, most of the cases with hostage negotiating is reasoning with somebody because something got out of control. Something went from one point to here without anybody helping in that mediation. And what I do is I come in and step it back. But, you know, to be clear, I negotiate with them, but we don't pay ransoms. It's not our thing because you set a precedent. Now, is there costs associated with it? Of course there is, but we don't do that. So that was the first involvement with an American service member, but he, and I don't know if you want me to go on to the, where we're at with all the special operations and all the military folks. And that was the catalyst. And that was a number of years ago. So.
Yeah. I mean, I am very interested. I know my listeners will be too. A majority of my listeners are military veterans or those who are major supporters of military vets. And so this is very, very interesting to me, the whole thing, especially because I remember when Montal was going through and talking even on his social media, his Twitter especially, and I had connected with his people then. It's fun to see how indirectly you were involved, or I was involved in talking to Montel about the military side of things while you're down there. We'll talk about that more later, offline, but, tell our listeners more about, I mean, I understand some of my listeners might not be Christian, but maybe you're thinking like there's a higher power that's got to be involved in connecting you to all these people and you just showing up and having these meetings with people. Even me, when I met you, I felt like, geez, I'm supposed to meet John for some reason. And I kind of know now, you know, talking about some Afghanistan things that I'll be talking about in some other shows. But tell me and tell our listeners how you are working with military as much as you can. I understand that some things are, you know, confidential, especially closer to today's day and time. We can't really talk about some of the new things, but tell us more about that.
So it is a wonderful story, and it's really a funny story. I've always been somewhat connected with friends, you know, in the military, and but really, if there was a point in time where it really escalated and I had to pinch myself, is because, again, you know, it ended up being through Facebook. So I was a social media guy, not for myself, but it was a conduit for all these people overseas that could private message regarding circumstances, because their cell phones didn't work, right? But they had the ability to private message. So, you know, I thought, wow, what a wonderful way to be able to communicate and get things done without having to jump on a plane and go to Haiti again, or El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, the island of Ometepe, Bolivia, Peru, Dominican Republic, Haiti, and Mexico. That was my territory. And I would have to go there like every couple months. And it was just draining. It was exhausting financially. And basically what happened is, a buddy of mine, a state trooper friend out of East Coast, had said, "Hey, John, I know you're involved with a lot of things, but you need to meet Johnny Walker." This is
back here. I love Johnny.
So Johnny, what happened is, and this is, it's an amazing story, and it's almost like a mini series the way that we met. So basically, and this is long winded, but I'll tell you, it's a good one. A friend of mine said, "You really need to meet this guy, Johnny Walker." And if you see on my kind of the thing we're doing to help with our family, my wife kind of put it into perspective that, yeah, I'm a talker. You know, I'll talk to anybody. And, you know, most of the time we'll hit it off. If you like me, you like me. If you don't, you don't. I don't, you know, I'm not going to be offended, you know, but we wear our heart on our sleeve and we just do what's right and just. And that's that. But I was introduced, a buddy said, "You need to know, look into this Johnny Walker." I'm like, "Johnny Walker, what the hell is that? Was he a drunk?" You know? And so basically I reached out to Johnny, I don't know how many years ago it was, I'm going to say 7, 8 years ago. And so Johnny, I, you know, we became friends on Facebook, and, you know, Johnny's got like 5-10,000 people who follow him. And, you know, I thought, you know, who is this guy? I understood some of his relationships with the teams. And so basically, I had reconnected with, and not going to use full names in this, but I had reconnected with a friend that was the sister of a patient my son's age when my son was dealing with leukemia. And she had joined the Navy. years later. And now she was working at a rather high level in the Navy. And I knew she was in San Diego and Johnny was in San Diego. So I'm going to go visit a friend that I hadn't seen. And people are going to say, you got to be making this up. Swear to God, people can vet it all they want. This is how this rolled out. I go to meet my friend that I hadn't seen since she was a little girl, and now she's in her 30s, and she's, you know, 17 years or 16 years in the Navy at that point in time. And I'm going to go have lunch with her, and I tell Johnny, hey, I'm going to be in town. He's like, yeah. Well, you know, Johnny, it's usually an explicit, yeah, F, yeah, yeah, come on over. Let's have a barbecue. And I said, all right. So, but I had to meet with Rachel first. So I saw Rachel and her family, and we hadn't seen each other in decades. And now she's in the Navy, and she proceeded to tell me that, you know, some of her choice to join the Navy was based off of what she had heard from me years ago. Not everything, just an element of, hey, I think I might join the Navy type of thing. And I think she was like 16, and she did. And anyways, me and her go on a hike, and she said, John, I don't mean to burden you with things, but I understand you do a lot of, you know, you've helped a lot of people. You've done a lot of work behind the scenes, and none of this was really social media or anything before. I mean, like, none of it's publicized. We don't really want it publicized because, you know, be careful what you wish for, right? You can only do things that you can do, and overpromising and under-delivering is, you know, more hurtful to anybody than, you know, attempting to help. So anyways, she says to me, and again, I got to be careful because she just got out of the military in the last month. She said, I see a lot of grievances in the military whereby pedophiles are getting slapped on the hand, and accusations between, say, people getting a divorce or bad relationships, because that always gets ugly, right? She said, I've seen some real ugly situations, and there's one in particular that just is haunting me. And so basically, this is where it gets surreal. So we're on this hike. I get a call while she's telling me this, and we're walking down this pathway, and a rattlesnake is right there, and it's ready to go. And we stop. I get a phone call at the same time from Johnny Walker, and Johnny says, brother, we're going to have to cancel tonight because I have a buddy coming over. I'm like, it's all good. I hang up. We turn around on the path, started walking away from the rattlesnake. Go back to the car, get another call from Johnny. And Johnny says, actually, why don't you come over? I know you don't drink, so maybe you can pick this guy up. I'm like, what guy? And he says, his name's Keith. I'm talking about Keith Barry. And I said, okay. So he goes, you know, he'll give you his info, you know, go over to Coronado, pick him up. So I go to Coronado, go over the, you've been there, obviously. I go over the bridge, get this address, pull up on the street at an address, and I'm looking around. I don't see anybody. Two doors down, this guy walks out. You know, he's got these aviators on, and thought, okay, is this my guy? It's got my guy. I'm driving my Jeep, you know? And so he walks up. He's like, John. I'm like, Keith. And he's like, yeah. Jumps in my Jeep. And we just had some small talk, right? We're on the way up, and I'm like, well, you know, he's still got his hair cut, and, you know, and the aviators on. I'm like, know nothing about him. And he says, and I said to him, well, where are you working? You out? He goes, just getting out. And I said, okay. I go, where are you stationed? He goes, you know, I was just at the brig. I thought he meant working at the brig. And so we get to Johnny's house, and I realize Keith's a SEAL. And Johnny's like, brother, where have you been? And Johnny didn't realize, and I didn't know, Keith had just did 2.5 years in the brig for something he didn't do. It was a false accusation from a Navy SEAL groupie, a career extortion person. And he was thrown in the brig and pretty much tortured. And Keith was the head of training over at Buds, had a TBI, PTSD, had a lot of, I mean, just a beautiful person. And I didn't know this guy from Adam. Now I'm thinking, did I just pick a rapist up? So we stop, we're at Johnny's and, you know, they're engaging, having their, you know, drinks. Another team guy comes over and a couple other Iraqis come over. And then they said, "Hey, John," meaning me, "have you ever been to Danny's? Danny's Navy SEAL Bar in Coronado?" I go, "No, I haven't been," you know? And they said, "Come on." So basically, you know, the ride there was kind of interesting because I'm like, "Okay, guys, can you put the bottle of tequila down? You know, we're going to get pulled over." And we get to the bar and Keith tells his story. I took one look at his eyes and went, this guy's innocent. And he disappeared. A few minutes later, I looked around and we were talking about it. And I said, "You know, well, maybe I can help. I don't know." And all of a sudden he was gone. And I said, "Johnny, where'd Keith go?" He goes, "Oh, he grabbed an Uber. He left." And he was really, you know, struggling. At that time, it was a few weeks. He had just been released from the brig on good behavior a few weeks prior. I got back home or to my, you know, hotel and started thinking about Keith and thought, I got to do something about this guy. You just know in your heart if something's wrong or something's right. Well, that next morning I woke up and I looked in the back of my car and Keith left his stuff in there, his aviators, his hat, and like a lunchbox. So I had his info because I had picked him up and I called him. I go, "Hey, Keith, this is John from last night." I go, "Your stuff's in your car. I'm sure you want it back." He goes, "Yeah, thank you. Maybe meet me over in Coronado." That's where we met. So we actually met over at, the old course at inside the base there, or over by the outside the base, and then went over to there and we got talking. And he told me his whole story of what happened. And I just said, "You know, maybe there's something I can do." I went back to Arizona and I started calling all my friends at defense and, you know, people in the media and said, "I don't know where this is going to go, but this needs to be looked into." So long story short, me and Keith got very close. General Mattis and other people got involved, the Deputy Secretary of Defense or the Assistant Deputy Deputy Secretary of Defense, who is a close friend of mine, said, "We'd look into, you know, let's look into this." People started digging, and what they found, and it's very public now, Keith's case turned into one of the biggest, you know, Keith, right? Or of Keith?
I know.
Keith's case turned into one of the biggest cases in military history because the Judge Advocate General of the Navy, the JAG, not a JAG, was ultimately convicted of unlawful command influence over Keith Berry's case because it was politically motivated. There was zero evidence, and they nearly destroyed this guy's life. I was with Keith every step of the way. Not that I was the only one. There was a lot of effort behind the scene. A lot of people because of that label. So he was a convicted rapist, with the felony conviction. This ended up getting reheard, like completely investigated. The convening authority, which was Admiral Lorge, had came forward out of retirement and said, "I shouldn't have approved the findings. I knew he was innocent, but for political pressure, I approved the findings and convicted a wrongly accused service member that had stellar, you know, history in the teams and, you know, just one of the best guys I'd ever met." And so I went to the debate hearing, sat with him, went to the CAF. So the, you know, basically the Supreme Court, sat right next to him as not an attorney, but his friend to the end. And his case got overturned with prejudice. He was reinstated in the military, given all of his benefits back. And he then retired. that was all an introduction through Johnny Walker. At that time, Johnny, and Keith's story is, it's a continuation. We talked today. He's, you know, we're just like brothers to the end. Well, that's what really got me involved within the special operations community. And fast forward to Eddie Gallagher's case, Keith and Eddie were good friends. And, you know, I was, you know, the Gallaghers had called and they had put together a defense team. I became real close with Tim Parlatore, who was Eddie Gallagher's attorney. And there were several other team guys and special operations guys that we were able to kind of get things squared away. So I ended up being an advocate without being an attorney. And, you know, whatever that is, providence or, you know, karma, is that as a non-attorney, what's the harm in somebody listening to me to try to express what we believe the truth is and to start digging into things? So that's been a continuation. And then we got really close on other cases, helping people. I won't name some of the other cases. They're all very much public, but we were doing it behind the scenes. And I was doing it behind the scenes because what had happened is not all press is good press, right? So suddenly you become a target if somebody believes that person should have been convicted or whatever. Just to be clear, I am not the guy to come to if you've done it. Not even close. In fact, and I'm going to be careful on touching on this, what the catalyst that really got me involved in giving back was something was presented to me, and I'm going to be real careful how I phrase this, about my family, which I had this kind of a sick feeling inside, knowing that there was something wrong, that I'm the guy that if you bought a used car and said, hey, John, look at this. It's perfect. It's spotless. There's not a dent on it. I will see every flaw. So those things come out, and I had a bad feeling. That's why I went to Navy, about circumstances surrounding our family. And then, you know, after my son's leukemia and when I started getting involved in giving back, I was presented with some really damning information about our family dynamic. Just imagine the worst. I'll just say it like that. And I gave an opportunity, as I always do, to get in front of things. They decided not to. I think that's when my world changed, and the people who I became acquainted with, whether it was, you know, individual politicians, heads of state, how does this happen? And it was, you know, really for me, it's good and evil, you know, and, you know, so there's a whole dynamic behind the scenes that, you know, continues my efforts in these things. But, you know, and then Afghanistan hit. So May, and this is a chapter in itself. I don't know. I mean, it has to do with the hundreds of people we pulled out of Afghanistan. But if you want to hear that story, it's really interesting how it rolled out. And that's, you know, and that was May of 2020. I lose track of dates, but I was contacted through a friend who said, hey, you know, there's a Major Tom Schumann out of Illinois, where I used to be, is trying to get his interpreter out of Afghanistan. And Tom was an active duty, you know, and still is active duty. And, you know, active duty personnel are kind of restricted in what they can and can't do because they're active duty. But people like myself, I was an E-nothing when I got out of the Navy. So it was just like, you know, what are they going to do to me? They're not going to, what benefits are going to, what are they going to do to me? I've been self-made ever since. Not that I have anything, but I have no, you know, no worry of, you know, having, you know, people in pensions coming after me or something. So basically what happened is this guy was trying to get his interpreter out. It was quite public at the time. And this is May, so before September of the exodus out of Afghanistan. And I thought, okay, let me see what we can do. And this is where it gets, you know, the 3 degrees of separation or what have you, is started making some phone calls, and we're going to get this guy out. But we were trying all methods, which was State Department, you know, local media, blah, blah, blah. So Anthony Blinken, who is now the Secretary of State, during his confirmation hearings, we were through Major Schuman and a network of people, we were able to get senators and Blinken to recognize the plight of these Afghan interpreters ahead of September. And they made a very public plea. He named this individual and talking about Blinken and Senator Dick Durbin, that they would help, that they wouldn't leave these people. They did. We knew that was going to happen. So behind the scenes, I started working with a close friend of mine who was the recently retired Commodore of the Special Operations Command. And we got involved in putting together an effort to get this particular guy out. And it's very public. His name is Zach. I mean, it went on Rachel Maddow, Fox and Friends, you know, the whole plight of please help this guy. And in the background, we were doing our work without, we don't want to be, don't talk about us because it could hurt their cause if you get some politician saying, well, Shattuck's involved and, he pissed off at the last administration for going where they told him not to go. But, you know, people are free and alive. So basically, we, you know, the operation was Zach became very public, and it actually turned into a book called Always Faithful. And it's being made into a movie right now. And it's about Zach and Major Schuman. And, you know, there's in their plight, but it really is a, you know, more of a documentary of the failure of the of our approach in the exodus. So that was just Zach. And I was, you know, the communications and the things that were happening with Zach was amazing, but that springboarded. We got Zach out and we got him out with pipe hitters. It was really people going outside the wire to do what was outside of the rules of engagement because they had locked down Karmadadzai Airport. But then we ended up getting like 400 other people out. And that took a toll on me. And it took a toll because it was a huge effort. But one thing that I guess there's some documentary on Amazon Prime about it, but we probably had 70, 80 missions going at a time with a lot of people who were self-funding a lot of this stuff. And, you know, I was just, you know, I was managing a lot of the operations in a sense. And keep in mind, I had no formal training in doing any of this. And it was just, I don't know, a God-given talent to be able to help, to be that conduit, to help connect people and getting it done. But we got a lot of people out, but a lot of people died. And that's the story that I really wanted to tell about, you know, these efforts is, you know, we did something called Girls on a Bus. It was an operation. It ended up being those, you know, several hundred girls that were staged at the North Gate that were manifested to be on a plane to get out of the country. And the Taliban knew that the girls were there. And, you know, I had people from the base calling. They're like, please talk to the commander. You know, they're not allowing these girls to get manifested. They were manifested, wouldn't even let them on the plane. They were left to die. And I ended up being admitted to Mayo Clinic with 200/110 blood pressure. Later, I think I had a nervous breakdown over it. And I've been watching my pressure as I talk, but you know, so these things just keep repeating themselves. And it's something we do. It's a passion. And and now I find myself in a predicament, you know, where, you know, like I said, all of a sudden our world came crashing down, and having to separate the anxiety of not being able to help and do the things we can and deal with my cancer diagnosis. So, you know, we're going to get ahead of it. It's just, I wanted to talk to somebody before I didn't have a voice. So.
But, yeah. And I definitely want to help you share and have people listen. And so important, your message and all of the things that you've done throughout your life, John, are really remarkable. You know, there's a lot of people in the world. There's the doers, and then there's the people who sit back and do nothing, and then they're the bad guys, right? And you're definitely one of the good guys. One of the things that I really want to encourage you on is you do have such a passion to help other people. I am sure you're going to come through like a trooper on this whole treatment process that you're going to have to go through. I'm going to be sharing your GoFundMe. I donated a little bit today, and I was very happy that you decided to go ahead and let people fundraise for you, because one thing I do know about you that you haven't really talked about a whole lot, you barely touched on it, was, you've donated so much of your time, your talent, your resources. You've given so much financially. I've been there myself at a point where you just give and give and give. And when it's time to get help, not always do people come forward for others, but you have a really great network. And I want to encourage my personal network to also donate. Not only did you go through all of those things with your son when he was little, and then your wife had that accident a month or so ago, and now you have this diagnosis on your shoulders, and I know it's not easy. So definitely, if anybody out, all of the people out there actually listening, go to check the links in the show notes. I'm going to have the GoFundMe account linked there. John did not ask me to say this. In fact, I hope I didn't embarrass you by bringing up the fact that, you've donated so much, and your treatment is going to be costly, even though you do have some health insurance. You have the co-pays, you have the deductibles, you have the time out of work, you have a family. So John, just thank you. You're quite the individual that I'm very blessed to know.
Like I said, we're all here for a, we all have a calling, and I'm just fortunate to have found my calling. But it's amazing to see the network that's kind of pulling together. And frankly, I've talking to my wife this morning, I've t told a number of people that if, I'm not the ask guy, I'm usually the being asked guy. But yeah, it's a tough one because, the medical side of things, and we'll get through it, and we have good doctors, good insurance, but there's a lot of other dynamics that I can't talk about that are at play because, just imagine, I think I talked to you about some of the evildoers who are trying to come at us for, trying to help people. And I know that going in, and I always said that my headstone will read, "No good deed goes unpunished." And I say that honestly because, I've been astonished in the last couple of days that people were willing to do this. And, I say, when my son was diagnosed years ago, we had a very successful business at the time, and the social workers came to us and said, "Your son can get Social Security." That was 28 years ago. And he was 2 years old. And I went, "Social Security? What do you mean? Social Security is for, older people and these other circumstances." And they were really trying to like shove that down our throat. And I thought, and I told them, "Save it for somebody that needs it." I mean, honestly, we didn't need it. We didn't need it. Why would I take that? And honestly, I didn't take it for that reason, but more so, I felt that if I accepted something that I didn't deserve or wasn't in need of, my son wouldn't be here. And I believe that. I believe that to this day. And it is a hard pill to swallow to ask for help, and that's something I'm gonna have to deal with. And maybe that they want me to go down to Mexico and do some Abogaine to get through some of the stuff that I've seen and done. But right now it is focusing on my family, and as you know me, with my I'm a grandfather now, and that's a whole different game changer. So that's my kryptonite, right? That's I can hardly talk about that because it's I need to be here for my family first and foremost. And, I want people to understand while we do a lot of the stuff that we do, I'm able to balance that. And I've been able to balance that for decades. And we have changed gears. I'm not jumping on a plane and going places all over the world anymore. Before this all happened, somebody finally said, maybe you should consult. I go, then I'm going to get paid. And they're like, John, you know, you can't, you got to think differently, but I'm not there yet. But, you know, for the record, I've never received compensation financially for this stuff. And, you know, the only one exception, and I have it in my, I finally put a scrapbook together because people, they used to do articles on things and that would leak out in the press for, I'm talking about just like, you know, helping in Haiti and stuff. And I finally put it together as a kind of legacy for the kids. Like, what did you do? What did you do with your life? Right. But I kept one thing and I almost want to show it to you, but it'll reveal the guy's name. It was another American in Haiti who, she was raped and she stabbed her rapist and it's Haiti, right? So she's in jail because she stabbed the rapist, right? And so I was able to, I knew I needed to act quick down there. And it was somebody that had helped me with helping me with other causes, but we got her out and I had to pay the family of the of what they considered the victim, the rapist who was stabbed. That's how it works in Haiti. You have to compensate the family because if the person that was stabbed, even though he's a rapist, he's the head of the family. So they're losing finances. So I had to pay like $5,000 to get to the family and she was released. Right. And I took it out of my savings. It was actually a college fund for my son. And, I have some angels that help us, angel investors, people that jump in and fund operations. And, you know, I can do the logistics. I can get things done. They can write a check. So that's the time, talent, and treasure. But this check that was written, and it was written to us, and it was the only time I ever received that or accepted that, was, and the reason why I'm saying this, in the memo section of the check, remember when we used to write checks?
Mm-hmm.
It said freedom. And I have it still in my scrapbook, and he's a very dear friend of mine. He was that John that was with me when I met all these actors through APJ when I thought they meant him. And so, you know, that was the one exception, but that was as a reminder, you know, that the check was significant to help to offset what I had to do personally, but at a time that I could least afford it, but it was that memo. And he reminded me, he's like, John, it's easy for me to write a check. I couldn't do what you were doing. Not that anything I was doing was exceptional, but freedom. What's the cost of freedom? And yeah, so I'll leave it at that. So,
and that's a powerful way to leave the show. John, thank you so much for being on the show. Do you have a public social media presence at all? Or I know you like to be behind the scenes.
I have, as you know, just that Facebook page is all we have. There's people that are tech savvy are building out finally a website, apparently, because they want to chronicle some of this stuff. Because basically what's happening is, yes, you can share my Facebook page, because my Facebook page is really more about these efforts, not necessarily my efforts for funding or GoFundMe, but they kind of chronicle a lot of the stuff we're doing. So that's the page we have. There will be a website up, and that website's going to be up soon. And that's really important because to me, because I have to hand off. So just this past week, I got a call within hours of the American being kidnapped in Haiti. An American nurse, white American nurse with a fork. A nurse, and there's another dynamic behind it. And, you know, we'll get her out, but she shouldn't have been there. And she's in a tough spot, but she shouldn't have been there. But we were able to hand that off. And what this website's going to do that they're building out is that, while I'm going to be down for several months, I'll have a feeding tube next week, which the operation is easy. It's the tube that I'm worried about, you know, but and not having a voice. But that website will help for people who may want to donate to the operational side of things. And we've named several institutions that we work with. So I, you know, we don't go in as cowboys. So a lot of the special operations guys, I do work with a lot of the, you know, because of Afghanistan, a lot of the active duty, you know, command master chiefs and different things. But we do that on the private side. So there's going to be a website available, hopefully in the next week, to be able to answer that side of things, because I'll be down, but I won't be out. And I want to make sure that efforts continue if they come in through, we're not advertising, but they come in through my phone and in my emails, those will be directed to somebody who will manage while I'm recovering. And it'll go into a formal website. And we probably should have done that years ago, but there's been no time. You know, there's just simply been no time. I work on scratch pads and I throw them into a folder. And that's an operation. I mean, I'm kind of old school. So, you know, that's my visual side of things. So I think I'm a little ADD or dyslexic or what have you. But and I could say that because my kids are.
That's okay. I'm all of the above.
And I believe that's where they got it from. So it kind of resonates.
Oh, man. Thank you, John, so much for being on the show. If you're watching and listening, you're going to be able to find John's links in the show notes. John, thank you again, and we wish you a very, very speedy recovery. We'll be praying for you and sending good thoughts your way. Thank you for being on the show, and everybody, remember, it really is about freedom.
I thank you so much, Patty, and it was a pleasure meeting you, and I know that meeting you was it was something that was meant to be. So it's not happenstance, right? So
that's for sure.
We got a lot more work to be done. And thank you for doing what you're doing.
Thank you. Absolutely. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Until next time, be sure to go back and listen to older episodes of Wake Up with Patty Catter. I appreciate you all. Have an amazing rest of your week.
Thank you for listening. Please head over to pattycatter.com for the latest updates on Patty, her talk show, and what she's up to. You can also find her on Amazon TV and Roku, and on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Patty Catter. Until next time.